He kōna I purangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
Kia ora everyone, Ingrid here. Welcome to today's episode of Morning Report Essentials. The essential chat this morning, a lot of it about MP pay rises, a lot of text feedback about that. Was there anyone in support of the pay rise, Corin?
Early on, there were a couple of texts in which people were saying that, you know, this happens every now and then, it's a bit of a beat up and people need to move on and that they have to be paid. But I think it would be fair to say the overwhelming number of texts were opposed.
Yeah, well, even the politicians say that they don't need it. I mean, they're going to take it, but they say they don't need it. So we had some good discussion about that with Chris Hipkins, also the taxpayer union too, and a bit of an education about Te Tiriti, the story being that there are moves to move that back up to Waitangi and house it there. But we did hear a bit of the history of the document that I hadn't heard before. Rats have eaten it in the past, apparently.
They like the parchment, apparently. Yes, indeed. It was interesting too, because there was also some text coming in on that. Not that keen on the idea of moving it back up to Waitangi. Some people suggesting that it was a national document and should be in Wellington.
Yes,
so that was,
exactly.
Interesting to hear.
Lots of feedback about that. Lots of information about that. So you'll be able to listen to this episode and make your own mind up. Enjoy the episode.
Well, the Labor Party signed off the agreement in July last year after 12 rounds of negotiations between 2018 and 2022. On the free trade agreement with Europe, opposition leader Chris Hipkins joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, it must be nice for you to see this coming, getting across the line, and early, in fact, too.
Yeah, it's a pretty exciting day for New Zealand, I think. I mean, it opens up such a huge, you know, a range of opportunities for our exporters. If, you know, if we take our beef exports, for example, we could see beef exports to the European Union treble. We could be supplying 60% of the butter that gets imported into the EU. We could be supplying that under this agreement. So that's just two of the examples. You know, there's a huge range of opportunities that open up for New Zealand exporters from this agreement. And, of course, we're very proud of the UK free trade agreement as well, which we see sitting alongside it, and which just opens up that part of the world for New Zealand exporters in a way that we haven't seen for several generations.
Just finally on this, it is a different world. Do you think it's going to be harder in future for the current government and future governments to do these sorts of bilateral deals? Does New Zealand need to think differently about this? Already it is, arguably, in that it is not so preoccupied perhaps with dairy and beef as it has been in the past, and that is a big barrier to doing a deal, say, with India. What's your sense about the level of urgency and direction for free trade, bilateral free trade agreements?
I think bilateral free trade agreements are likely to get harder when we look at kind of who's left, who we could do deals with. But the potential for multilateral free trade agreements, such as the CPTPP, for example, I think there's more opportunity to expand market access to New Zealand goods through those kind of agreements, and we should continue to actively, you know, explore and support international discussions around, you know, where those opportunities might exist.
All right, let's talk about MPs' pay rises. Your view on this, is it something that you should be getting together with the government on and some sort of bipartisan approach and intervening and blocking?
Look, I think it's terrible timing, but the reality is I think MPs should stay out of the process. I think every example of where we've meddled in the process as a parliament in the past has led to actually worse outcomes rather than better outcomes. So we should leave it to the Remuneration Authority. I think I understand New Zealanders' frustration at this, and they'll look at this and they'll think, hey, that's a bit unfair given the challenges that they're facing at the moment. But actually, it's the challenges that they're facing that we should be focused on. You know, this government are not doing enough to help New Zealanders with the cost of living. They're not doing enough to grow New Zealanders' incomes, and their priorities are wrong. You know, they put $2.9 billion into tax cuts for landlords rather than cost of living support for New Zealanders.
So you are defending that pay rise in a sense, because, and I'm interested in that, because the Taxpayers Union was on this morning, Jordan Williams, saying that the government is effectively borrowing $70 million a week at the moment. It does have a structural deficit that it has to fund, at the same time as paying its MPs more, at the same time as the government, and your government too was looking at making it to some cuts, not as extensive obviously, in the public service. So how is that justified?
Well, I think we have to focus on getting the government books back into surplus. Now's not the time to be doing billions and billions of dollars worth of tax cuts.
How is the MPs pay rise justified at this time, given all those factors?
Well, it's never a good time for MPs' pay rises. And, you know, I think that's one of the reasons that we should keep out of it. I'm not going to justify it. I think that's the job of the Remuneration Authority.
Now, your pay as for the opposition leader is being reduced slightly, still around that. What I think it's going up to over 300,000, isn't it? But by no means as much as the other positions. And this is because of the changing nature of the opposition leader, apparently, that there are other minor parties who play more of a role now as well. Do you accept that?
I don't agree with the Remuneration Authority's analysis, but I don't necessarily disagree with the outcome. I think I'm a well-paid New Zealander. I'm not asking for a bigger pay rise. I'm not asking for any pay rise at all, to be frank. I don't think their logic is correct. I think, the reality is under MMP, there are still really only two potential prime ministers, the leader of the country, the prime minister, or the leader of the opposition. I'm not asking for more money. I don't agree with their logic. I don't have a problem with
that. But you accept that you, as the opposition leader, you have a role to play, that you should be paid the same as a cabinet minister?
That's been the previous benchmark. If they'd continued with that, I would have been fine with that. The fact that they're not, I think that's really a decision for them. As I said, we stay out of these things. We stay out of them when it's to our advantage. We stay out of them when it's to our disadvantage.
The Prime Minister's signalled he'll give his extra money to charity. What will you do with your pay bump?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a regular contributor to charitable causes, and I intend to continue to be so. You know, I think those of us who are on high incomes, we should properly pay our fair share of tax, and I do that. But we should also make sure that we're contributing to the society around us, and I do that, and I'll continue to do that.
The Taxpayer Union says the Parliament's pay rise is out of touch with the rest of the country as the average income of households goes backwards. The Remuneration Authority has determined that backbench MPs' incomes should increase from $164,000 to $181,000 over the next 3 years. The Prime Minister's salary, that will jump from $471,000 to $520,000. Cabinet Ministers will go from $296,000 to $327,000. The last increase was denied by Jacinda Ardern back in 2020 when her Cabinet voted to take a pay cut during the pandemic. Joining us now for more on this is the Taxpayers Union spokesman, Jordan Williams. Kia ora, good morning.
Good morning, Ingrid.
Now, you were calling on MPs to reject this increase.
Yeah, we're calling them to put their money where their mouth is. You know, numerous leaders, the Prime Minister, the Minister of Finance have said they don't need or want a pay rise, then don't take it. Taking a little bit of a fall to say we're going to give it to charity isn't really good enough. The point of increasing pay at a time when literally the average household income is going backwards simply protects the 100 MPs for which most of us have never heard of from the economic reality facing New Zealanders.
They've also said, though, that the Remuneration Authority is an independent body. They shouldn't be interfering in how salaries are fixed, and they should be at arm's length from that.
Well, let's just step back. I mean, two things. You mentioned the headline figures there of a backbench MP, which is very misleading because it doesn't include, for example, backbench MPs under this proposal will be getting nearly 20 grand tax-free allowance for things like clothing, even luggage, and for gifts. Well, I mean, you know, you work in media. I have to put on a suit to get to work. I don't get $20,000 tax-free on top of the salary, and yet that's what these backbenchers are getting. I mean, also just as a point of principle, MPs' pay should be set before each parliamentary term, not increased year on year, no matter even if the people that they serve are going backwards. The Remuneration Authority concluded in its own report that, quote, there is no evidence to suggest that salary levels are a barrier for people entering politics. So they don't need to increase it. They are choosing to. MPs are saying, oh, well, I don't personally want it.
Well some of the simple. MPs are saying that, and some of the higher paid ones Minister.
All it takes is Christopher Hipkins to get together with the Prime Minister. The Prime Minister is already saying that he doesn't need the money. The Minister of Finance is saying she doesn't need the money. The extra money for MPs is literally being borrowed. We're at a state right now where the government is borrowing $70 million a week. New Zealand households are going backwards in terms of their real income after tax that they are taking home. A lot of your listeners listening to this will be struggling to make ends meet.
Oh, absolutely.
Why should we be borrowing to put up MPs' pay when the independent body that they're pointing to is saying they don't need it?
Well, they haven't had a pay rise, some of them, since 2017.
Neither have the average household, in fairness.
But some people have it, and this isn't even keeping up with inflation, so between 2 and 3% a year. Isn't that fair?
You stand for politics, for public service. We pay our MPs, you know, so that that's not a barrier to getting into public service. You've got the Independent Remuneration Authority saying that what they're paid currently already covers that. If you're not there for public service, if you are there making the argument, well, you know, we haven't had a pay increase since 2017, maybe you're not there for public service. Maybe this isn't for you.
But don't we need to have the best people and offer good salaries to get them there?
But, as I say, the Remuneration Authority is saying that there's no evidence that what is being paid now is a barrier for anyone going in.
But it has. It's taken all those factors into account. It's taken the current economic climate into account, and this is
it's gone against its own conclusions. And, I mean, to be frank, you know, the Remuneration Authority is tasked with taking the economic context and realities as a factor. Clearly, they failed to do so. Because when the average household is going back, because one of your earlier texts said, you know, it's never a good time to increase MPs' pay. Well, I tell you what, it should be done before the Parliament begins, and that should be stuck to
for
the 3 years.
But they also have
and
a point, though.
And it shouldn't
though.
Be there's, done there's when the government's a... borrowing is in deficit the, and households are literally
borrowing,
going backwards.
Though. There's never been a time
what?
Where they
We're
have...
not normally
they,
borrowing $70 million a week.
They've never been a time where someone had said, you know what, that's a jolly good idea, let's give them all a pay rise. I don't recall any reaction to any of these pay rises.
I think that's because
like that.
New Zealand has for some time now. I mean, it's basically us, Canada and Australia that are very high when you look around comparable salaries around the world for ministers and prime ministers and legislators.
The original Treaty of Waitangi could be returning home for good some more than 180 years after it was first signed in the Bay of Islands. The 9 signed sheets that make up Te Tiriti are currently housed at the National Library in Wellington, but there has long been a push from Northland Iwi to bring those papers back to the treaty grounds. Our reporter Tu Whenaroa Natana Hira is with us now to tell us more. Kia ora, good morning.
Tēnā koe, good morning.
So this, as we've said, has been talked about for quite some time. Why this push now, some actual action?
Well, we should start off with the Waitangi National Trust Board Chair, Peter Tipene. He joined the board in 2016. He was elevated to chair in 2018. And one of his first moves really was to make it explicit that the treaty should return back to Waitangi. And so that's been the opinion of the board since then. These talks, I think the fairest thing to say is that they are still in their intimacy, and so they've been going on for at least 2 years. That was confirmed to us by Peter last night. The way he described it is that they've been talking with officials, the first meeting a couple of years ago just for Waitangi, and then indeed this year, a few days before Waitangi commemorations, they spoke with the chief archivist, Anahira Morihu, and the details of those conversations aren't known right now. But he describes them as being sort of initiated in good faith and also mutually. And so the question I asked was, well, who, you know, started the conversation, bringing them back initially? He said, well, you know, they sort of approached us and we sort of approached them. They already knew what our position was. And so it was sort of a mutual kind of interaction there. So they've been going on for quite a while. We got a statement last night from Archives New Zealand as well. In it, they say that, you know, they've been engaging in very, very early discussions with Ngā Puhi Nui Tonu around, you know, the future of these taonga. And it's important because they've put a couple of dates in there, 2035 and 2040. Those are the dates in which both the He Whakaputanga and Te Tiriti were signed. And so there'll be the 200-year anniversary.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the rough timeline that we're working with.
So it's still a way away.
It's still a little way away, yeah, certainly. But, yeah, that's all we know at the moment.
And what about the logistics of actually, well, firstly moving those documents, I mean, and then housing them? How are they stored?
Well, at the moment they're stored in pretty state-of-the-art conditions down in the National Library. They're open to the public, and they have been since the 90s, first at Archives New Zealand, and now at the National Library as part of an exhibition called He Tohu. And so you've got three different documents there, three very different, important and different documents, He Whakaputanga, Te Tiriti o Waitangi, and, of course, the suffragette petition from 1839. So they're housed there. They have sort of state-of-the-art casings to keep them protected from both light. They have humidity controls and temper controls within the casings themselves and also within the room, and also, of course, very, very strict security measures as well to make sure that they aren't sort of tampered with or taken advantage of. I was talking with Peter last night, and, you know, those facilities are state-of-the-art, and his perspective and the perspective of the board is that, you know, they understand that. But over the years, Waitangi has now, I believe, two different museums, maybe three different museums on the actual grounds themselves. And so the capability is there in terms of physical housing, but there needs to be further discussions about, you know, just logistically, where are you going to put them? Mm. How are they going to be available to the public? And how much money is it going to cost, I think, ultimately, to house them properly?
Yeah, yeah. Huge responsibility. I mean, not they're up for it, obviously, but at their tongue, as you say. They weren't always treated so well.
No, no. Even just, I believe it was about a year or two after they were assigned, in 1841 or 1842, they were housed in government buildings down Auckland's Queen Street, a long time ago now, and there was a fire that erupted. And thankfully, there was a record or a clerk down there. I forget his name off the top of my head, but he went down there and he saved them. He ran into the building, grabbed the documents, came out. Thankfully, they were saved. Fast forward to 1908, they were discovered in the basement of the old government buildings down in Wellington. They were described at the time by the person who found them as being held in a dungeon. And so they were found in a state. You can imagine that the original parchment was a full sort of piece of paper. Mm, mm. By this point, they'd taken on, you know, the physical appearance that we know the tree to be now, which is sort of rat-bitten and deteriorated. They'd been taken away by temperature fluctuations, by water, literally by rats. I found out over the past couple of days that rats actually quite like parchment because they're very sort of nutritious compared to normal paper. Fast forward again to 1913, between 1913 and 1915, there was an attempt to restore them, right? And it's arguable as to whether that restoration process was actually beneficial. They put them on a new piece of canvas and they sort of glued them and used an adhesive that left parts of the parchment sort of very stiff and other parts of it really stained. Fast forward again to 1961. Along the way, they travelled all over the country. They'd been everywhere from Masterton to different sort of government buildings around Wellington. But in 1961, for the first time, they were available for public viewing. For the first time, really.
Wow.
They were available for public viewing at the Alex Turnbull Museum. And they were housed in, effectively, a glass cabinet. And so they were there until, I think it was 1977. And they found out along the way that the place in which they'd put them had been causing extra damage. Some of the cloth that they'd used had been deteriorating the parchment. The harsh light inside of the museum as well had caused fading on much of the inscriptions that were there. And even in 1940, that was the only time that it's ever been back to Waitangi, and that was for the 100-year celebrations since the Treaty of Waitangi signing. Finally, in 1991, they were returned to Archives New Zealand, where they were put on public display in, again, really sort of state-of-the-art state-of-the-art sort of housing facilities. But they've been all over the place. Mm. They're in the vault of the Reserve Bank there for about a decade as well, in a little tin can.
We're going to go overseas now because a number of student protesters at New York's Columbia University have escalated their protest against the war in Gaza by breaching and barricading themselves inside one of the institution's main buildings. Now, hours earlier, the university started suspending students who defied Monday's deadline to vacate their encampment. That is all the tents in the middle of the campus. Video footage shows dozens of students smashing windows and carrying barricades into the building.
Get
Now, this same building was occupied by students in 1968, protesting against the Vietnam War. Well, joining us now from New York City is our correspondent, Ira Spitzer. Good morning, Ira. What is the latest there? These students are still in the building.
Well, good morning to you. And according to one of the groups that has helped organize this protest, they've recently indicated that there are about 60 people who are inside Hamilton Hall after having barricaded themselves into that building on the Columbia University campus. I should mention that Hamilton Hall has a history of being involved in on-campus protests, most notably in the 1960s as part of anti-Vietnam War protests. Hamilton Hall was also occupied at that time. So protesters perhaps using that as some inspiration for this current protest. And this came about after an escalation. We saw police or Columbia officials giving protesters a deadline of about 24 hours ago to leave the encampment or face suspension. That some people left, but many stayed. And then eventually that night, things escalated with the actual occupation of this building. And now those students are facing the threat of expulsion. So talks are apparently ongoing, but certainly this has really taken things up a level. And of course, we've seen these protests spread across the country at many college campuses, dozens around the U.S. right now.
Joe Biden has not spoken on this, has he? There has been a statement from the White House, but clearly the politics is coming into this. He obviously is looking, needs the support of younger Americans to back him. At the same time, he's clearly concerned about some of the protest rhetoric as well. It's a very difficult balance. What is happening on this front? Do you expect this to ramp up?
Well, we've seen some condemnation basically from Democratic leaders, including from Joe Biden's spokesperson, John Kirby. Earlier at a briefing, he told reporters that the president believes that forcibly taking over a building on campus is absolutely the wrong approach, calling it not an example of peaceful protest. We also heard from another Democrat, the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, saying that smashing windows with hammers and taking over university buildings is not free speech. It is lawlessness. So we have seen the tone kind of ramp up among those more moderate Democrats. But of course, this whole thing does present a conundrum for the president. He's obviously being blamed for largely for what is happening in Gaza, but also he depends on many people who may support the protesters or be the protesters themselves to vote for him, because the Republican Party is even more hawkish traditionally on Israel. So Biden walking a fine line right now with how to respond to this.
What is your sense in terms of public support for the students and their protest?
It's very hard to say right now. We'll know, of course, a bit more as the weeks unfold. There certainly is a lot of discussion today about whether taking the step of actually occupying the building, and this also happened at a university in Northern California, whether that could turn people off to the protesters' cause, which includes demands such as for these universities to divest themselves from investments that support Israel, for example. But yes, there's a lot of discussion whether this could turn Americans, especially middle of the road Americans, off who may have been sympathetic to the protesters. I think there's certainly going to be some truth to that, but the extent of that, I think it's hard to know right now. This is an unfolding event where each day you can't quite predict what the next development will be. So the Columbia standoff is really, really, really having people talking right now about how far is too far.
Buses, trains and ferries are more expensive today around most of the country after funding for free public transport for children and half-price fares for young people under 25 ended. Now, some councils continue to fund cheaper fares for select groups, but not in Auckland and Wellington, where students, they will be particularly affected. Our reporter Nick James is at Victoria University's Kalbin campus, and Jill Bonnet is at Massey University on the North Shore. Let's go to Jill first. What are you hearing out there this morning, Jill?
So the students here are not happy about how it's going to affect their budgets. As you can hear in the background, buses here are coming in once every couple of minutes, and it's difficult for them to imagine how they're going to pay for the transport to get to university, but also to get to placements. That they've been talking about how in the countries that they've also studied in, it's a lot cheaper, and saying that for some, they're thinking about actually just turning up in a car instead.
There's a range of concessions, isn't there? And because some councils are able to subsidise, but not Auckland yet.
Well, Auckland, in theory, is giving 20% to tertiary students, but that's down from a half price fare for them. So for this age bracket, they're quite badly affected. And one student told me that system isn't working anyway. He's already tried to get on and it's not worked for him anyway. Elsewhere, the school children are also affected, because I suppose the most affected are the 5 to 12-year-olds, where parents weren't having to pay for them to get on a school bus. But they will have to pay, and the prices also for the 13 to 19-year-old bracket have doubled.
All right, thank you, Jill. Jill Bonnet there. Now, at Victoria University's Kalbin campus, Nick James is there. Good morning, Nick. What are you hearing?
Good morning, Byron. I've been here as tens of students have been jumping off the bus to get to their early morning classes. And essentially, the response I've heard is that they're not happy with it. I've heard varying responses of disdain towards the return to full fare prices, with some saying that it's frustrating, annoying, and that it will drive more people back to cars. They've also raised concerns about how it will impact the economy, with the potential of less people moving around, and how it will impact the environment.
Yeah, and remind us too, I think we heard yesterday, there's there is always some subsidy from councils, but it's not enough in this instance. There's still some concessions. What's the situation in Wellington?
Yes, so in peak times in Wellington, those aged 19 to 24 with a SEPA card in zones 1 and 2, which are sort of the central city locations, will be $1.84 and $3.02. However, if a traveller is studying at a tertiary institution, those fares are $1.38 and $2.27, respectively. So a bit cheaper, but people are still feeling the pinch here. Most of the people I've talked to have said that, people will be bribed away, and that they're pretty gutted about it.
Well, that's today's podcast.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. Tune in tomorrow, wherever you get your podcasts from.
The TUI, RNZ National.